You're listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California. Listeners, I am so glad that you could join me today. My name is Lois Richter, and the program is called That's Life. Today, I have with me a friend that I've had him on my show a couple of times. That was the Birding with Lois show. We had such a good time, and I have found that he's written a new book. Now, you may not know this, but John Muir Laws has written a whole bunch of books and done a whole bunch of presentations. I first became aware of him when I was looking at one of his bird ID books. And oh, it was so nice. The drawings were so good. Anyway, he's done it again. So this is my friend Jack, also known as John Muir Laws. Hello, Jack. Glad to have you on the show.
Lois, I've been so looking forward to talking to you again.
We had such a good time. And I want to tell people a little bit about some of the stuff that you do that they can participate in.
Okay.
So Jack does presentations on how to draw, how to record things in a thing called nature journaling. That's his thing, natural journaling. And it means where you take a book that you can write in, and you go out and you look at things, and then you write down your observations. And you might be a great artist like Jack is and draw beautiful pictures, or you might have little stick figures, just sort of like I do, or you might write down what's going on, or draw a diagram of a tree or whatever it is. So Jack, how are you encouraging people to do this that my listeners can join in on?
Well, first of all, the process of nature journaling is something that is really accessible for anybody to do. You don't need to be a naturalist. You don't need to be an artist. You don't need to be a poet to pick up a notepad and a pencil and to go out into nature and start to record your observations. We've developed a whole bunch of tricks and techniques that helps people use drawings and pictures, diagrams, words, to be able to write their own poetry, to be able to make deeper and richer observations of the natural world around them. And the more that you do this, the better and better you get at it. And to help people along this path, the Wild Wonder Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that I helped start, and I have been providing lots of free or low-cost resources for anybody who wants to do this. So I teach every week free classes in how to do nature drawing and how to keep your own journal. We have online conferences where people can learn from nature journalers around the world to be able to develop their skill set. We have also programs to help teachers be able to do this with their students. And it's an incredible educational tool. And it's a really wonderful tool to help you get more out of every walk in the woods.
And if I don't have woods, I'm sitting in an apartment in a city, I can still do nature journaling, can't I?
Absolutely. One of my favorite things to do is to go on a safari in my refrigerator.
What?
And so I'll just go through the refrigerator and like, oh, look, here's a tomato that's starting to go funky, or in the pantry, here's a sweet potato that I neglected for way too long, and it started to sprout. So any little moment of nature, whether it's a house plant, a bird outside the window, or a lemon that you brought home from the grocery store, if we can get ourselves to look at it with intentional curiosity and to push our ability to observe more deeply, we can find wonder and beauty in even the most commonplace objects that are around us all the time.
That intention and curiosity are two words that you'll hear Jack talk about all the time, because the curiosity is what lets me or provokes me into finding out more and poking at that leaf and figuring out, no, why is there a little divot in the edge of this? It's a perfect circle going around in the edge of this. And then maybe I will want more information, so I'll look it up, or I'll talk to somebody, or I'll write down questions in my journal, and then later on go and find out, oh, that's a leaf cutter bee. Oh, they're making those little perfect circles on the edge of the leaf, and then they're lining their nests with it. Well, isn't that cool? Well, if I hadn't been curious enough to look at the leaf in the first place, I would never have found out all that other stuff.
That's right. I think that curiosity is the secret sauce to being alive.
Yes.
And we don't have to sort of wait for curiosity to come knocking at our door. Mm-hmm. We can intentionally and deliberately enhance our own curiosity and start asking more questions about the world around us. And as you described, sometimes we're able to look things up. Something that I really enjoy doing, though, is to find a little mini mystery around me and not look it up. Resist that temptation to get on Google and try to get a quick answer. What can I figure out myself from my own observations, or maybe poking and prodding and doing a little bit of experimentation? And if I do go on to online and start looking something up, what can I do to then find the next question on the other side of whatever answer comes to me, to keep myself in a perpetual state of wonder and curiosity?
So once I found out if it's a leafcutter bee, then I look around at the plant and I see it's a red bud, and that's the mm-hmm. leaf that's being. And there's on that one leaf, there's like four or five different circles, and another leaf on the same plant. Oh, there's another couple of circles, and but the red bud right next to it has no circles.
Mm-hmm.
Why pick this plant instead of that plant? Well, that would be an interesting question to try and figure out. I don't think I could figure it out experimentally, but that would be a fun thing to check into.
No, this let's just use that thought experiment and run with it. Let's say we make that observation. So first of all, good for you for looking carefully enough to make that observation, because for most of us, we're not carefully observing this beautiful world around us. Maybe we get to the point where we can identify something. We can say red bud, case closed, we're on to the next thing. Or maybe we can get to the point where we can say red bud with a leaf cutter bee cut out of the side of the leaf. But then to actually notice that this one over here has it, this one doesn't, there's something going on here.
Mm-hmm.
That really kind of shows that we've trained ourselves to slow down to a pace where we can start to let in the wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I might go about it several ways. One is I might sort of park myself next to the plant and see, can I find leaf cutter bees coming in? If so, when they leave, where are they going? Can I chase them across the meadow? Can I find where they're going to? Will there be more leaf cutter bee cuts tomorrow? What about a week from now? Is this little difference that I'm seeing with where the leaf cutter bees are nibbling, is that just sort of the chance of the small sample size? Or is that red bud that is right next to this other one really not getting tagged? All of those are things that we actually could investigate and pick at. And what's also really neat about that is that when you're kind of playing with a question like this, the answer isn't out there in Google anywhere.
No.
You're not able to because you're probably the first person to have ever asked that question.
Well,
And
I'm
then
not, but that's okay. It's a possibility. One of the important things about nature journaling is that it persists. That is to say, you're working in a journal that's a book. So I do something today, and then, in a few days I'm doing something else. In a few days I'm doing something else. 3 months from now, I may flip back and go, oh, I wonder what happened to that leaf cutter bee thing. And so I could go back and I could see, well, there's exactly the same amount now as there was before. There's been no activity in 3 months. I wonder why that is. And then I can come back in the spring and suddenly there's leaf cutter activity again. What's going on? Oh, it's nesting material. Of course. I wonder when they may make their nests. I wonder how that happens. All of those questions can't be answered right away, but if you come back to it, maybe you'll figure it out.
That's absolutely right, Lois. Our memories are terrible, terrible, terrible things. But if we put the notes down in a book, maybe with a little diagram or two, that is going to hold those memories across the seasons. And next spring, we can continue geeking out on whatever that little mystery is. But if we were just relying on our memory, two things. One is, it's most likely that we'll just forget about the question and sort of skip along. But having recorded it in my journal and looking back on that, some months later, like, oh yeah, the leaf cutter bees thing. Oh yeah, I got to remember to kind of go back to that. So paying more attention to it and getting your questions and your notes down on paper is step number one in helping you be able to play with this.
And then talking to other people. So maybe when I'm in one of your groups, and there's groups where people share what they've done, and maybe I can go, there's this leaf with this leaf cutter bee, and see, here's a drawing of the leaf, and notice how the circles are always at the edge. I wonder why. Okay. And then maybe someone else has noticed the leaf cutter or hasn't yet, but might go and look.
That's right. And that's why we started nature journal clubs all over the world. There are nature journal clubs popping up where we get a critical mass of curious people with notebooks in their hand, and we go out into the woods and we just geek out together on nature phenomena. And we find all of this fun stuff and we start exploring it together. And that person over there really knows botany, and that person over there has got some art tricks up their sleeve, and that person over there, maybe they even studied bees. But when then you get a critical mass of these curious people together, it is so much fun to geek out on these sorts of things with other people. So at the Wild Wonder Foundation, we created a nature journal club finder where you can find a nature journal club of like-minded people near you. And if there isn't one, we've got instructions on how to start one of your own, and then you can put your club location up on our finder. And it's just so much fun to play in nature with other people on just these sorts of mysteries.
So, listeners, you heard it here. Nature journaling clubs. So, Jack, what have you done with this book that just came out? Now, I know you had a what do you call it? A bookwarming?
A bookworm, that sounds nice. A bookwarming party. So we had a bookwarming party. And so there are all these chili books. And they were just sitting in boxes, feeling unloved, fresh from the printer. And so we up in Sierra Valley, in the Sierra Nevada, we got a critical mass of people together who were excited about these things. And I did a little bit of a presentation, showed everybody that new book, passed them out, and sat around talking about how cool the Sierra Nevada is and loving on our birds. This book is a field guide to birds of the Sierra Nevada. And you might be thinking to yourself, wait, you already did one like that. And you'd be absolutely right. What happened is,
That's my question is,
yes.
why are you getting a second one? Did the birds
Well,
change? Did your drawings change? Did you find out more stuff? Did you just run out of books of the first one and you wanted to do a new one? Why did you do a second one?
well, the answer to all of those questions is yes. So it's been 20 years. And in that time, I have had so much more practice, thousands more drawings. And I'm now much better able to draw the birds of the Sierra Nevada. And I look at those drawings and I thought to myself, there's a bunch of drawings there that if I rework those, it'll really help somebody be able to identify those. There were several mistakes, even that I made in my drawings. And as I look back over them, it's really fun for me to sort of notice what kind of mistakes I made, and why those came about. It's kind of an opportunity for me to psychoanalyze the artist who I was 20 years ago. So it's really fun to look at the drawings that I did before and find where are the inaccuracies in my old drawings. Well, no drawing is perfect. No drawing looks like the bird. Doesn't matter if you're Audubon or David Sibley, the bird is different than our picture of it.
Well, and it's
And
different from moment to moment. It's twisting
that's right.
and turning and flapping and yeah. So
So
which pose are you going to choose
that's
is
right.
a
Did
big thing.
I put in a pose that isn't sort of a typical pose of that bird? Did I overemphasize things that I was really interested in? I'm drawing a picture of a grosbeak, and they have these really big beaks. And I'm looking at that, I'm going, wow, your beak is so big. And that idea is then in my head as I'm drawing it. And so I don't draw just a big beak, I draw a huge beak. So it's not just a grosbeak, it's a really, really, really grosbeak. And I also have learned a lot about color. And as I look at the birds in this book, I realize that something that wasn't really on my radar when I was making that book was the idea of the color magenta. And there's a bunch of birds with magenta in their plumage. And back in those days, I was thinking, magenta is light red. And I would see magenta and I would paint light red. The purple finch has a beautiful magenta head. I was not really aware of the color magenta when I was working on my field guide. I was thinking that magenta is light red. Turns out that it's not. Magenta is a real big deal, a really big deal in color and color theory.
What color is magenta? Is it purple?
No, it is the best way to describe it is magenta. So it is not light red. And kind of hear me out on this. It is not light red. It is not reddish purple. It is not any of those things because it turns out the magenta is really the primary color. Red's not the primary color. This is a whole other kind of rabbit hole, but perhaps kind of fun for our listeners because I grew up here, reading Mouse Paint and all these other books about saying that red's your primary color. So then you see something that is sort of pinkish and you go like, oh, it's light red. Just add white or water to your red paint and you'll get that sort of magenta color.
And then you
Or
find out that the printer is using magenta and cyan and yellow.
that's right. That's right, exactly. So your color printer has known all along that it is cyan, yellow, magenta. You mix those together, you get all the colors. So if your printer takes a little bit of magenta paint and yellow paint and puts those together, it makes red. And the same thing happens with your watercolors or acrylics or oils. But if you don't have that magenta paint, and I didn't, then you're thinking like, oh, there's that light red again. Your brain doesn't look at it and realize, oh no, that's magenta. It's a whole different kettle of fish. And
Very
so
difficult to make something that looks like magenta if you're starting with red and blue and yellow.
yeah, you it's one of these sort of wonderfully you can't get there from here sort of situations. I remember being in the middle of the desert once with a beautiful pink cactus blossom in front of me, and I was trying to match this bright magenta pink, the sort of light magenta. It was a beautiful pink. Think of like, hot pink. How would you mix hot pink? Take your
Well, I need
red.
the tube of magenta, personally.
You need the tube of magenta. Exactly. But there I was in the middle of the desert. I was trying to match that color. I could not do it, Lois. I couldn't do it. And the reason I couldn't do it is because you can't do it. It's people think like, oh, just mix a little bit of blue in, it'll be kind of purplishy. Nope, that makes kind of purplish. And
You
a
can get
dull purple at
close.
that.
You can get close. You just can't get there.
I would say that it's not even close. Once you see magenta and you recognize it as its real thing and you start experimenting around with your paints, it's shocking. And then you realize that if you are, say, mixing colors with your magenta, you take some of your mixing colors with your red. If you take red and you mix it with one of your blues, you get dull purples. But if you're mixing magenta and blues, you can get bright, beautiful, beautiful purples and violets. So it has this cascade effect all the way down your color mixing. It's really, really fun. So, but this my first set 20 years ago, I was in, let's call it my red phase, right?
There's also which red, which yellow, and which blue are you
Right.
starting with? I know I've taken some basic painting classes, and they say, okay, we want a red and yellow. Well, then you go and you look at the blues. How many different blues are there? Well, okay. And so which blue do you choose? And that's why they always had us take the paints we had and then make what they call a color wheel to see what this red and this yellow make. It makes it orange, but what does the orange look like? It depends on which pigments you're using to get
That's
there.
right. That's right.
So,
And I think the blue is a kind of good example of that, because just as magenta is your kind of primary color for mixing, blue isn't one, but cyan is, kind of going back to your color printer. But most of us have actually a really good cyan in our palette, although the tube of paint is usually named blue.
Phthalo blue, are you talking about?
That's right, phthalo blue. So we've got, if you've got phthalo blue, you actually have cyan. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, you're just playing a game with the names there, right? But check this out. If you look on the side of the, what is the chemical name of the pigment inside your phthalo blue, the pigment's name is actually phthalocyanine. It's got cyan in its name. But for most people who've been trained, you need red, yellow, and blue. You want to kind of get that primary into their hands. If you call it cyan, they'll say, "No, I need a blue. I need a blue." So the paint manufacturers call it phthalo blue.
There's also a phthalo green, phthalo being the mineral from which your pigments are derived.
That's right. There's phthalo greens. There are. It just sort of depends on kind of how you treat it. And there's also phthalo blue red shade and phthalo blue green shade. And so for the best cyan, you actually want to reach for your phthalo blue green shade. And then you get a beautiful, beautiful cyan. So my blues are better, my cyans are better. There's also, a bunch of birds that I had painted blue are cyan. And so
Or they're mixed and they're iridescent, they're reflective.
That's
So
right.
then you have an even bigger problem if you're trying to paint it on a flat white piece of paper.
Yep, those little hummingbird gorgets.
Oh, yeah.
If you are watching a hummingbird and it turns its head sideways to you, that beautiful bright gorget turns black. It's an interference color that is from the way that the feather structure bounces light back. If you were to take those little feathers from the red gorget and grind them into a powder, you don't get a red powder.
No,
You get
it's
a
gray.
gray powder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing with just in case the listeners aren't familiar with it, we have in our area Anna's hummingbirds, the males of which have a gorget that is a head covering of feathers, and the feathers are attached to the head, not to the body. So when it turns its head, this sort of flared feather cap turns with it. Okay, so if you are looking at a hummingbird and it is staring off into the distance, You go, oh, it's a little bird's got a black head. And then as soon as it turns its head and looks at you, oh my word, it's this rosy red, pink, magenta maybe color that is flared at you because it's looking at you.
That's
And
right.
so,
And your position relative to the sun is also important. When they are doing their displays to a female, what the males do is they come zipping down in a wild dive, and at the bottom they quickly bank and turn and flare their tails, and their tail feathers actually make this bright chirping sound. And as they come whipping up towards the female, then they have the sun behind her, and they're then on the other side.
they're
And so the
reflecting like
sun is hitting
crazy.
full on that gorget. And the female then sees this bright little jewel of red suddenly appear before her, with a sharp squeak. And then the bird sails up into the air a little bit more and zig-a-zig-a-zig, sings a little bit, then goes up and does it again. It does it again. It's a wonderful little display.
And those displays are different from species to species.
That's right. That's
What
right.
Jack is describing is the Anna's hummingbird display. Now, the other hummingbird that is resident in my backyard is a black-chinned hummingbird. They have a different display, they have a different courtship routine, but they still have part of their feathers iridescent. Now, the black-chinned hummingbird is such a really weird name. This is a little bird. It's even smaller than the Anna's hummingbird. And it doesn't have a full head gorget, but what it has is black underneath the bill. And then between there and a little bit further down, it has these feathers that in just the right light look purple.
That's right.
And it is a gorgeous thing if you ever see it,
Beautiful.
but it's very rare to see because it's just a tiny little patch on this tiny little bird. But
And that black-chinned hummingbird is another reason why I had to make this new field guide, because there were several birds that were omissions, birds which should have been in the book, my first edition, but I didn't get them in. Primarily because of sort of where they were breeding, I missed a whole bunch of really interesting birds, and the black-chinned is one of those. So that first edition of the book, no black-chinned hummingbird in there.
no black-chinned hummingbirds. Oh,
I
Jack, you
know
have to
it's
do a new book.
that's right. You got to have a new book. You got to have a new book. There's all sorts of other crazy things. Since I made that book, condors have started to make encroachments into the Southern Sierra, so we need to bring those in. There's some birds just like, how did this one miss getting in the book? The little Sora rail, that if you're out at a marsh and you hear that descending whinny of a call, and it's a wonderful little marsh bird, but it just was not in that first book, decided to walk out of the pages. Oh, here's another example, and this kind of shows my bias. When I was working on my book, I would be running around in the Sierra Nevada all summer. And then when fall would come and the flowers would wilt, and I would retreat to the comfort of the California Academy of Sciences to start, continue working on drawings of birds from specimens in drawers. But meanwhile, this
You missed
migration.
all the winter migration.
Exactly. So there's this big summer bias. So the ferruginous hawks and rough leg hawks, which show up in the winter time, where were they? They were missing from the book. So it was just so interesting for me to notice, like, how is my ability to draw changed? What am I noticing now that I wasn't noticing then? What are birds that I missed in it? And what does that tell me about my bias? And also, for a number of other birds, birds have been split into different species. So before we had the Western scrub jay, now you've got a California jay and a wonderful woodhouse jay. So for a number of different species, they were split into two different groups.
And some of them were lumped. like we have yellow-rumped warblers, used to be audubons and myrtles. Now they're all called yellow-rumped warblers, and it's just the different subspecies, as it
That's
were.
right. And those ones may go back to being different species. This is something we have to wait for. Somebody got their PhD splitting those into separate species, and somebody else will get their PhD, I suspect, down the line, putting them back together again. What people are doing is they're looking at genetically how different are these, how much hybridization is are there in these. And just how different are these birds, and do the difference between them, are there things which we can pick up, but you look at the birds, and the birds really don't care.
One of the things that I always find interesting is you can have a group of birds where this one looks this way and this one looks that way. And every bird you see of that species will be either one way or the other way. There won't be a lot of stuff in the middle. And then you see other species where there's the range of looks from this to all the way over to there, and there's lots of stuff in the middle. So that's one of the things. I had a really good show on the Birding with Lois videos, and we were talking about lumpers and splitters, and that was a great show. And what I finally decided was, you're meeting your neighbors, these birds, and I know this is Fred and George and Mary, and it doesn't matter if they're in group A or group B.
Oh, I like that. That's right. And the name is not the thing. The name is not the thing. The bird is so much richer than its name. The names are useful to help us communicate with each other, but what we want to do is to look at those birds as the Fred and George and Mary and meet those individuals where they fly. And if we just look at them from the perspective of we're going to name them and move on, we just miss so much richness that is there. I absolutely agree with you on that. And also, like, what is a species? As you start to kind of unpack that, it becomes really nuanced and weird and messy. It becomes messy very, very fast. I originally learned the idea of species as these are non-interbreeding populations. And so I thought, oh, that's pretty straightforward.
So the problem with that one is that, let's use that yellow-rumped warbler as an example again. The audubon's warblers over there, and the other ones over here, the myrtle's warbler, and there's nothing in between because the groups weren't overlapping. Well, they spread and they overlapped. And they went, oh, that's really the same bird, isn't
Yeah.
it?
Well, and then there is, so if there is hybridization, then you're wondering how much hybridization is there? How fertile are those offspring? Is that hybrid zone growing? Is it staying the same? What differences, and then it gets even more fun if you're looking at something like insects, where
Oh, no,
nobody.
we're not going to do insects.
Oh, but we'll just dip over there for a moment, just so to be
There's
aware that
thousands.
nobody is out there looking at if this species of fly is mating with that other species of fly like they are. Birds are big enough that we can watch them. And when a hybrid shows up, it shows up on everybody's on all the rare bird alerts, and it's reported over on eBird. But there's no such thing. There's no such thing for the little bugs.
You're going to start an e-bug?
Oh, wouldn't that be fine? That would be really fun. iNaturalist gives us some of those capabilities, but they're just defining a species as this one kind of looks different than that one over there, and it's got a little bit more hair on its tarsus. We want to call that one a species, Sally? Okay. Yeah, let's do that.
And then you get to plants, and then you get even weirder. We just, I do the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore, who's a plant expert, and someone sent in a picture of something and said, you were talking about what you might grow in a shade garden. Well, here's a tree for a shade garden. He sent me this picture of the weirdest thing you've ever seen. It's a stick with downward pointing leaves that look almost like needles, but they're big. And it just grows and grows and grows. After about 15 years, the top suddenly changes, and it gets shoots on the side, so it now has branches, and the leaves are no longer these little strappy things hanging down. They're big leaves, and it looks like a tree. And it's just this. So when the Europeans came, they called them two different species.
Oh, that's fun.
But this is just a juvenile form, and it keeps that little skinny thing until it's up high above all the other stuff, and then it becomes a tree-like thing. It's all weird.
Yeah, and we'd made the same mistake with dinosaurs. We find some dinosaur fossils. Here's this little tiny ceratopsian with no horns. And then in the same area, you're finding these big ones with horns.
Wouldn't that be mama and baby?
That was what somebody's insight eventually was. They were like, wait a minute. If we look at, say, bighorn sheep, you look at a big ram, you'd think that its skeleton is different than a youngster. And so if there's different age classes, that then becomes this whole other wonderful wrinkle in how we figure things out. And what's neat about this is that because it's sort of messy, the process of figuring this stuff out is just so much more fun, and it's interesting. And it gives us a little bit of insight into the evolution of these different species, their connections. But still, at the end of the day, as you were saying, the name is not the thing. It is so much wider and richer and more wonderful than the than just the name. And so as we start to look at the behaviors, as we start to look at the varieties, this process of birding just opens us up to so much beauty and wonder everywhere around us.
So I have to come back to the book. And when you were thinking, oh, gee, I'm going to do another book, I'll just do an updated version of this book. Did you have people who looked at and read the 20-year-old book to say, okay, you expert birders, look at this, see if you see any mistakes or absences, or this species does have a juvenile form that wasn't in the old book? Or did you get a lot of people helping with figuring it out?
That's right. Anything that I do, the more that I can kind of crowdsource the wisdom of our community, the better off I am. What doesn't stand out to most people are the absences. You can look at the picture that somebody did of the peregrine falcon. You can say, like, how good a peregrine falcon is that? But that same person who really knows the peregrine falcon, it's a different thing for them to critique that drawing versus be able to say to you, you know who's missing? And just sort of a quick, funny story on advice on how to build the book. I had finished the drafts of the book. It was in the process of being printed. And in the process of being printed, we realized that there was a little mistake in it that we needed to stop the printing and fix this. And I got the files back, and while they were back on my desktop, I was talking with a friend of mine who is an educator in the Feather River area, a naturalist named Rob Wade. And he does these wonderful programs with the kids in the area. In every school throughout in Plumas County, there's this really, really beautiful, rich environmental education program. And I believe it's the fifth graders. The fifth graders are in every school in Plumas County are studying birds. And so he's out with them all year round and brings them through Sierra Valley. And just to kind of to get a pat on my back, because I thought, like, now I've got everything covered, I just offhand said to him, like, so Rob, is there anything else that needs to go in the book? And without losing a beat, he said, oh yeah. He said, I would love it if he said, please tell me that in the second edition, you have the ferruginous hawk and the rough leg hawk. And I realized as my blood froze on that moment that I didn't. Right. And so, but then I realized that the thing is,
it's now back in my control, but how can I fit two more hawks into this? Now, fitting a sparrow, another sparrow in, okay, no problem. But a hawk, there are dark morph and light morph versions. There are female and male versions, and there's adult and juvenile versions, especially when you get something like the rough-legged hawk, which has, oh, it can look so many different ways. Putting in the rough-legged hawk and the phryginus hawk, this is no small feat. What I had to do is I had to figure out how I could clear an entire page of the book to bring these two hawks into it. So I had to put in an entire new page. But if you do that, then it's going to break the pagination of all the stuff after it. So you can't just add another page in the book and then flip the next one over to the next page, because
page 25 and page 25B.
Yeah. So I struggled with this, and I figured out how to get the rough leg and the phryginus hawk into the book. But that one, that little suggestion came at the last minute. And I was just thinking like, obviously I should have talked to Rob before, because he's somebody who's out all the time with kids. Here, what's that? Try to find it in the book. Kid says, I can't find it in the book. And then he realizes, it's not
it's
in the
not
book,
in the book, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so he said, like, you've got to have those ones in there. It's so much fun to sort of see how all these changes come about.
Mm-hmm. When you make a book, now you've done a whole lot of books. I know you're doing a lot of stuff every week on the Zoom, and recordings and videos and all that stuff, but actually making a physical book, printed book. How many of those have you got now?
Oh gosh.
I was trying to count them and I couldn't.
I could try. Let's see, there's the Law's Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling. Wrote another book for teachers, How to Teach Nature Journaling. This Law's Field Guide to the Sierra Nevada. And then we have a separate book on Sierra Wildflowers and the Sierra Birds book. Don't know if it counts as a book, but there was a pocket guide set to the natural history of the San Francisco Bay Area. Oh, and How to Draw Birds.
Mm-hmm.
So we're up to seven there. And am I forgetting anything? I don't think so. Another one in progress right now, working on another one. So that list will grow at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was seeing are all of your how to draws. And I thought they were books, but if they're not books, what are they? How to draw mushrooms, how to draw an owl.
So for some of these things, I've got little handouts that are used in my classes. There's a how to draw mushrooms section in the Law's Guide to Nature Drawing and Journaling.
Uh-huh. And you're going to be doing another presentation in December, right? An event on how to draw mushrooms?
That's right. Just in time for mushroom season here on the West Coast. We've gone through a long dry spell, and we're looking forward to a winter of little mushroom friends popping up. Right now, as I look out the window, rain is coming down pretty solidly. So we're in a storm that is passing through the Bay Area at this moment. And we're hoping that that's going to give us a really deep soaking. And that's what's going to bring out all our mushroom friends again.
So if people want more information about this, I know you said it's the Wild Wonder Foundation. What is the website URL?
That's wildwonder.org. And
Wild
it's a
Wonder.
Nonprofit organization which we've created to help spread nature journaling worldwide.
Right.
It's a wonderful community of people who have come together to share these resources and the inspiration of nature journaling. I also have a personal website that is johnmuirlaws.com. And there you will find thousands of hours of free videos and nature drawing tutorials and those sorts of resources to help you be able to develop your own nature journaling practice.
Wow. I just looked at it. I just went to that website. I was on the other website, but This is amazing.
Go to the video archive there. There's a little thing you can point to, click from that
Video
landing
archive.
page.
How to draw? Is that what you're looking at?
So you could get that, or sort of like past classes. I forget what I've called it. It'll bring up a kind of curated list of, let's see. So if
Recent
from that,
letters tutorial archive.
free online lessons. So you go to that free online lessons button.
Anyway, there's a lot of stuff here, and you could get lost in there, and you could spend weeks just watching his how-tos and following along and replaying the parts that didn't quite get, because he's faster than I was. All this stuff is just wow.
So yeah, what I recommend people do is to use this as a little bit of inspiration, but the most important thing is to get ourselves outside. Get ourselves outside and start playing with this wonderful world and see what we can discover from our own observations and our own time in nature. It is a little bit ironic that I am encouraging people to develop nature connection by creating videos off the machine and out into the woods or out into whatever natural area is calling you. And
And if you get turned on to this, listeners, there is a place on one of his websites where you can download a one-page picture, and then when you fold it up, you end, or I guess it's 2 pages, isn't it? You fold it up and you end up with this wonderful little book on a quick start guide to nature journaling. I love these kinds of things. It's so easy to get people in there.
yes, that's a wonderful tool to get yourself started. It's what's called a zine, which is a foldable little booklet. You can go to the Wild Wonder Foundation website and you'll easily find it there. So it's a downloadable zine. You can download it in color. And then it's a fun folding process to turn it into a book. And then you can open it up again and refold it, and it's a different book. So with zines, because there's two sides of that original piece of paper, one side of that ends up being one book. The other side ends up being all the little pages in the second book. And if you've never played with a zine before, they're really fun.
I do artist trading cards, or at least I used to, and they're 2.5 by 3.5 inches. And if you work it right, you can do a zine that, when it's all folded up and done, is an ATC.
Ah, very good.
Yeah, that's it. So let's get back to, oh, I have so many questions I haven't been able to ask you. I'm going to start with the one that most people would think of when they saw your name. John Muir Laws. Are you related to John Muir?
Yes, I am. I am a direct descendant of John Muir, just not the one you're thinking
Oh,
of.
okay.
Yep. So yeah, the John Muir that everybody knows, who gave us Yosemite, the great naturalist. I am not related to that Muir. Although if we do go back far enough in human history, we do find that we all eventually share a common ancestor. So by the same token, you and I are related.
Oh, I'm sure we're like 16th cousins or something.
When sort of it's a mathematical necessity when we kind of when we start looking back far enough. But yeah, John, I'm named John after my grandfather on my mom's side, and Mir after my great grandmother on my dad's side.
Cool.
And but they did really like the way that those two names came together.
And that's, of course, why you are calling yourself Jack.
That's right. Yeah. And also, Jack is just so much shorter than John. It's just
Well, it has been fun having you on the show, and I really appreciate your being here. In the last minute that we have, anything you want to leave our listeners with? Anything?
Oh, sure. Here's kind of a fun thought. We have this very, very short period of time to be alive on this amazing planet. And I think one of the most powerful things that we can do in that time is to train ourselves to pay attention. to pay attention to this beautiful world that we're in. And the more we do that, the more we develop a profound connection with place, with people, and that gives us meaning and belonging. It's through the act of attention that that transformation happens. And what I want to do is to invite you to consider using journaling as a tool to connect yourself with yourself and the world around you. If you have ever kept a diary, you know how that allows you to connect with yourself in a profound way. So too does keeping a journal of your experiences in the world connect you with that world around you. There's lots of free and low-cost resources, ways to kind of get involved starting doing this. I want to encourage you to look up and research nature journaling as an activity. And you may find that there's even a nature journaling community growing near you. And it's just a delight to connect with this. It just gives us more. It's another reason just to be joyful that we are alive and to experience this short life with greater depth, appreciation, and love.
And love. And I do love nature, and I'm thankful for your inspiration. There are so many people that are now better off because of you, because of all the work you've done. So thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to you today and to share these thoughts with your community.
All right, listeners, that's it for another show. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. And if you want more, you can go to my birdingwithlois.global website, and you will find there an interview. This was a video interview with Jack, and you can hang out with that. Or you can go to the wildwonder.org and look for the community calendar, and you'll find all sorts of activities and events and wonderful things. And then you can check out the groups map. So you can, there's a map there where you can find out where you live and see if there's a group around with you. All right. Well, thanks. Good night. And this is Lois Richter with the program That's Life.
Thank you.
Well, that last music that you heard was a song that I just created. I'm calling it La 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 One because I have a feeling I'll be doing a few more of those. And I started with myself singing a melody, and then I got the computer to create all those other instruments that were above, behind, around. So it's pretty strange, isn't it? It was fun to do. I hope you have fun doing stuff like that too. You have been listening to KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Well, I will see you sometime at one of your journeying classes or maybe even at the teacher thing.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you know that applesauce can be used in making cakes? If you have a box mix, you can replace the liquid, that's the water or milk or oil, whatever, with a cup of applesauce. And it works great. And it doesn't change the flavor, but it makes it very, very nice. And if you happen to have any extra bananas, let's say you've got a slightly overripe banana, you can squish that up and put it in your cake. And that will make your cake moister, and it will mean that day after day it will absorb more water out of the air, and so your cake will get softer and softer and softer. You can do that with brownies, with cake. I did it with blueberry muffins recently, and it was great.